Hello everyone, and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where I, Rod Jones, content manager, and Kate Cooper, head of research policy and standards at the Institute, take a critical look at what's been happening in the world of leadership and management up to the 20th of July 2020. Hello Kate.
Hello Rod.
Well, our first story, Kate, asks how should leaders prepare for a summer of uncertainty? According to new research from business intelligence and advisory firm Gartner, leaders around the world are in a psychologically fragile state as they ponder the prospect of a second wave of COVID-19. A global survey of 131 senior executives in multiple industries ranked a second wave as the top emerging risk to corporates, with concerns expressed about the new working model the pandemic has necessitated and the strategic corrections that firms have had to make to contend with the virus's commercial impacts. Gartner's Vice President Matt Shinkman said the research reveals the psychological fragility of most business leaders heading into summer, advising that employees and customers alike will require psychological guidance and encouragement, highlighting the important role of risk managers in helping leaders contend with both the new working model and the strategic corrections. Kate, what behaviours and skills should leaders develop to deal with these uncertainties?
First thing that strikes me about this, Rod, is that somehow we're suggesting that pre-COVID-19, we could predict the future and we weren't in a state of uncertainty. And of course, that has never been the case. And what has always struck me about people's almost obsession sometimes with strategic plans and forecasting, that uncertainty is incredibly uncomfortable. People don't like it, and they try and make things certain by creating plans, which of course we know never actually happen because things change. Now, COVID-19 has, in a way, enabled us to talk about how frightening uncertainty is, but has always been the case. So Matt Shrinkman saying, well, let's think about risk, I think is a much more accessible way of thinking about the future. What might happen? What could happen? What do we think really will happen? And how are we going to manage for that? And one of the good things, in a way, about a second lockdown, let's hope that one doesn't happen, is that we know what the first one was like. We've got that experience to draw on. We'll know how to respond much better than the first time round. So I think if I had to advise leaders and managers about coping with these uncertainties, it's just a recognition that that is what leading and managing is about. It's about uncertainty and being ready.
Well, thank you, Kate. And our next story, in some ways, is connected to this, because our story asks if positive thinking in leadership is overrated. Scientists at the University of Bath tracked people's life expectations and actual outcomes of 600 participants over the past 18 years and found that overestimating success compared to setting realistic goals is detrimental to well-being. Associate Professor Dr. Chris Dawson said, plans based on inaccurate beliefs make for poor decisions and are bound to deliver worse outcomes than would rational, realistic beliefs, leading to lower well-being for both optimists and pessimists. Particularly prone to this are decisions on employment, savings, and any choice involving risk and uncertainty. Dawson added, for many people, research shows that you don't have to spend your day striving to think positively might come as a relief. We see that being realistic about your future and making sound decisions based on evidence can bring a sense of well-being without having to immerse yourself in relentless positivity. Kate, should leaders embrace that sense of relief, or is there still plenty of room for bullish confidence and optimism stemming from attitude rather than evidence?
I think they should embrace that sense of relief, because what's always worried me about positive thinking, growth mindsets, resilience, is how somehow it locates the problem, the responsibility for whatever happens within the individual. And if you're in an organisation that keeps making life difficult for you and unpleasant, surely the solution isn't, well, just become more resilient or have a growth mindset or reframe this in a positive light. The solution is to make your job easier, to make the organisation kinder. So this questioning of the idea of a growth mindset being the solution to everything, and even Carol Dweck, who was the person who originated this term growth versus fixed mindset, she did recognise that we're not all of one or all of the other all of the time. And if we look at any sort of model of teamwork, we know we need pessimists and optimists. We need fixed mindsets and growth mindsets, because it all contributes to a team that is successful.
Well, thank you, Kate. Our next story looks at how winning at all costs may have led to abuse in sport. This is a widely publicised story, and the Conversation reports on the letter on Twitter in which top British gymnasts have reported that abuse in their sport is completely normalised. Under the hashtag Gymnast Alliance, stories include how the sport of gymnastics for many years has cultivated an environment of fear and mental abuse. They claim the culture of winning and criteria for success have created a cycle that perpetuates abusive practices, portraying them as acceptable and at times necessary. Many suggest that while welfare issues have been raised with British gymnastics, they have not been taken seriously. There is a lot of focus on looks and weight and how having the right body equates to success. This has created practices such as daily weighing that promotes harmful bodily expectations, which can badly affect self-esteem and lead to eating disorders. Kate, would you agree with the Conversation that elite sport often strives for the Olympic motto in which athletes become faster, higher and stronger, but we need the same dedication towards safety, welfare and protection for all?
Yes, Rod, I think we do need that same dedication towards safety, welfare and protection, because underpinning all of this, and we've discussed ethical leadership so many times and in relation to sport, that looking after your athletes fairly and consistently and putting their welfare before winning has to be the right way to run a sport. And of course there will be transgressions and people will not get it right, but that should be called out. It shouldn't be that so many gymnasts in this case have got together and had to put on Twitter what is essentially their disquiet with the practices that have become normalised for them.
Thank you, Kate. Our next story is that a four-day working week is to be introduced by Morrisons as support for the concept grows in wake of the coronavirus crisis. More than 1,500 staff will be paid for doing a day less as supermarket giant overhauls its way of working. When staff begin to return to work to the Bradford-based office next week, they will do 9 hours instead of eight, with a six-hour Saturday shift once a month. A four-day week has become an increasingly popular concept in recent years, with campaigners not only claiming a better work-life balance, but also increased productivity, because evidence suggests better refreshed staff are better motivated. They argue it would also stimulate the economy by giving people extra time to spend on leisure activities. At the end of June, the crossbench group of UK MPs wrote to the Chancellor suggesting a four-day week could boost certain sectors of the economy while providing more job opportunities. Kate, we have looked at the four-day week in previous podcasts. Do you believe it is now time for leaders to take this idea more seriously?
It's certainly time for Tesco, Sainsbury's, Asda and other supermarket chains to take it seriously, because if we were looking this as an initiative in the talent war, Morrisons are going to win. And I think what coronavirus has taught us about being able to flip to home working from things that can be easily flipped, those benefits of control over your working day, of feeling valued, absolutely important in all industries, whatever the job. And I think Morrisons is sending a really good signal out here to its people. We value you, we want to keep you, and we think the contribution that you make is still worth what we pay you, even if you're present for fewer hours. So well done, Morrisons, and they will be rewarded. They'll be rewarded in improved loyalty. And if you think in a supermarket, so many of the staff are on the floor dealing with customers, how well that will impact those important customer relationships. People are going to be less likely to change and move to a five-day-a-week job, saving Morrisons those recruitment, induction and new employee costs. One would expect, I suppose, the other supermarkets to follow suit. But this, to me, is how what changes in one sector broadens the debate in others. And I'll be so interested to see how successful this is.
Thank you, Kate. Well, our final story is a new study that suggests there is more to great mentorship than just subject matter expertise. Brian Uzzi, a professor of management and organisations at the Kellogg School of Management, has published research showing that mentorship is certainly beneficial, especially when mentors pass down unwritten, intuitive forms of knowledge. For many of us, that's a new way of thinking about mentorship. Uzzi says that people almost think of the mentor as the real active element. The mentor is the passive element, absorbing the mentor's knowledge. Some of that's true, but it turns out it's not really a one-way arrow. It's incumbent upon the mentee to branch out, take their mentor's tacit knowledge, and do something that breaks new ground. The mentee has a big responsibility for their own success. Importantly, as far as we know, the fullest transfer of tacit knowledge is conveyed in person. What this research says to me is that you really want to respect the value of face-to-face interaction.
Well, sometimes you get what appears to be research or new research saying things that we've known for quite a long time. And one of those is that actually mentorship is a two-way relationship. We hear the term reverse mentoring, which was associated with young people teaching older people how to put a profile on LinkedIn. But it's absolutely far more than that. A mentor can learn so much from a mentee about what's current, what are the trends, what are the problems that are facing younger people in the workplace, new ideas. So it's never, to me, been a one-way relationship. And of course, in conversation, and that's one of the reasons that we at the Institute value conversation so much, is that you are always conveying that tacit knowledge when you're having a conversation with people. You're telling them so much more than the word, and you're certainly telling them so much more than you'd ever be able to do if you could write it down and send it to somebody in an email. You can't give somebody advice by email, or not great advice, can you? You want to see their reaction to what you're saying, listen to their questions. Mentoring is so much a two-way relationship. So as I said, it's good that it's been highlighted as such a beneficial activity, but a lot of this doesn't sound new to me.
Okay, thank you, Kate. And that concludes this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the News and Views section on the Institute's website at institutelm.com. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.
Thank you, Rod.